going to kick off with part two of this two-day webinar series on mine tailings fundamentals. I'm going to call up presentations here to help introduce our very own session moderator, Michelle Mahoney. Again, Michelle Mahoney is joining you from the same office here at EPA in the Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where she's been working for 14 years here at EPA on contaminated site remediation and reuse within the Superfund program. She provides support to practitioners on the use of soil amendments and remediation for redevelopment, reuse, ecological revitalization, terrestrial carbon sequestration, and urban gardening. So Michelle, I'm going to gladly turn things over to you to kick off today's presentation.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jean, for getting us kicked off today. I welcome everyone back from yesterday, this part two of our Mining Tailings webinar series. Today we're going to have three speakers. We have John Hillenbrand, who's a geologist with 27 years of experience in water quality and solid waste. And for the past 20 years, he's been working at EPA Region 9, specializing in mining, covering California, Nevada, and Arizona. And then again, we'll have Jim Kuipers talk, and he's a mining environmental consultant with Kuipers and Associates, where he's worked on mining environmental projects, including engineering design, permitting, operations, reclamation and closure, water treatment, and financial assurance for well over 30 years. And then we're going to be joined also by Bill Albright, who's an emeritus research professor at the Desert Research Institute, and he has 30 years of research experience in environmental science, including topics such as waste containment, near-surface water balance, regional air pollution, and weather modification. So I'm very excited that we're going to have these three speakers. It'll be a great complement to our session, which we had yesterday. And just to recap, yesterday we talked about what mine tailings are, how they're stored, some of the features to consider when locating and designing the facilities, how these facilities are operated, some of the issues with operating tailings facilities, and then talked about some ways to prevent future events of failure, such as the one that we saw in the video yesterday. So today, we're going to kick it off with an introduction by John Hillenbrand. So I'm going to turn the presentation over to you, John.
Thank you, Michelle.
Presenter rights here.
My name is John Hillenbrand. Good morning here from San Francisco. And as Michelle pointed out, I've got four quick intro slides that many of you have seen already from yesterday. As far as tailings is concerned, you know, we all know there's many environmental aspects of mining, and tailings are one of the more important aspects that we run into. Whether it's working on NEPA projects or actually working on permitting in mines or at Superfund sites, tailings seem to be a pretty important part of it. So these seminars are hopefully useful for beginners as well as experienced people. I know I learned a bit from Jim Kuipers yesterday as he was going through some of the opening parts. When we deal with mining, it often helps to look at it from the mine life cycle perspective. And yesterday's talk by Jim covered the first two parts, the mine planning and permitting and the active mine life operation, how tailings impoundments are made, how they're operated, good ways of operating them, et cetera. And today's second part will deal mostly with the closure and post-closure aspect. So Jim is going to talk a little bit about how to close tailings facilities, and then Bill will talk a little bit more about the reclamation aspects of the tailings facilities. So I think an important distinction to make, I made this yesterday, was the difference between modern mines and legacy mines. And I think a lot of Superfund sites are legacy mines. The picture on the bottom is from Arizona at a site, at a Superfund site. And these are the types of situations we're trying to prevent where they were unplanned, not particularly well engineered, and just kind of plopped in a convenient canyon. And what we're going to talk about today is mostly more modern mines where they're planned ahead of time and they can be closed methodically with planning. And then my last slide here is just a real quick slide. The slides on the right are from the Cypress Tohono mine in Arizona, where a successful closure was done about 6 or 7 years ago now, and they've had no infiltration from a nice evapotranspirative cap that was placed on there. So I'm sure Bill will be talking a lot about that today. But I also wanted to share a little more perspective on why capping and covering is so important. This is a little graph of the different types of remedy components that Superfund has run into nationwide at about 88 of its mine Superfund sites. We have about 540 different remedy components, and of that, about 124 of them, or about 23%, include some type of on-site disposal with capping, covering, and revegetation. So this aspect is really important for Superfund. So after Jim talks a little bit about closure, then we'll run into this cap and closure and revegetation aspect of facilities. All right, Jim, off to you.
Good morning, everybody. Today, I'm going to lead off the presentation on part two of our webinar on mine tailings fundamentals, addressing, as John has mentioned, the current technology and practice for mine tailings facilities operation and closure. I have at the beginning of my slide a couple of, or of my presentation, I should say, I have a couple of slides that I want to go into that address some comments that were provided relevant to yesterday's presentation. And if I can get control here, okay. One of my colleagues, Dan Overton, who's the principal with Engineering Analytics, and I say a colleague, I work with him at the Cuesta Mine site in New Mexico as part of a technical review group. He brought to my attention a mistake in a figure that I relied upon in yesterday's presentation, and some of you may have noted that I stumbled a bit even on this slide. I certainly noted I did. Because as you go through it from the source I used, which turns out to be an EPA 1994 report, that it really didn't make sense. And I know Steve Vick well enough to know that he, of all people, would not make the kind of mistake that appeared to be in that table. So I wanted to take this opportunity to insert a correction slide. It's slide two of today's presentation now. And in that slide, I provided the correct figure directly from Steve Vick's publication, Planning, Design, and Analysis of Tailings Dams. And for those of you who might have that EPA report, you may want to take and put a big X over the figure that was used. And I apologize for that, as this makes much more sense. The second correction or addition I want to make, really, came from John Kurth with Montana DEQ. And he let me know that, in fact, the Metal Mine Reclamation Act amendment was passed that basically takes a look at the effects of Mount Pauley, and particularly the recommendations of the Mount Pauley Review Panel, and incorporates those. And I might mention that I was provided an opportunity to work with the Montana Mining Association and comment on it. I know that Dirk Van Ziel and I believe Dr. Morgenstern also commented on it, and I think this is the first real response regulatory-wise to Mount Pauley that I'm aware of anywhere. If there are others, I think myself and others would be very interested in seeing those. So thanks to both John and Dan. Very much appreciate those comments. So today's discussion is about what happens when tailings facilities are closed. This is an area that I've spent a considerable amount of time over the last 15 years in particular working in. I've lived next to many different tailings impoundments. I've worked on many for different groups, for government and others. There are many aspects of it that we're still learning about, is one of the key things I would mention. A lot of the projects that I've seen in doing tailings reclamation and closure have been done once, sometimes twice, and in many cases, parts of them, such as stormwater designs, covers, and other things, have had to be redone. What I'm showing in this picture here, by the way, is a tailings impoundment at the Tyrone Mine in New Mexico. the initial design experienced a severe stormwater event and essentially was destroyed, might be one way to put it. It was severely damaged, is another way. As a result of that, the engineers and folks who were working for the Tyrone mine put their heads to things and came up with a different design. And it's a very intricate design that I'm showing here involving, if I can get the cursor, this is the downslope parts of a very large tailings impoundment, and let's see right there. This is actually drainage channels at various intervals along the face, and then you see that there are actual swales that go up and then down leading to those channels. The idea is to not conduit all the runoff into one place until we get to the bottom of the slope, and this, I think, was a much more successful design. So when we talk about tailings, these are the subjects we're going to address. I'm going to try to run through the first five here in a relatively brief fashion and then leave time for my colleague Bill Albright to present in much more detail the subject it covers. I might mention that if we have an opportunity at another time, that same kind of detailed coverage of each of these subjects that I'm going to try and present in brief format certainly is warranted. So, and I apologize for the color on some of these slides. I was hoping it would not be quite so, not contrast so poorly. This is a slide addressing the concept of design for closure. And one of the reasons I included this particular picture on this slide is it incorporates the thought of doing concurrent reclamation on a tailings impoundment slope as it's built, essentially building it at a slope that it meets final reclamation requirements for both stability as well as for cover and makes maintenance and other things of that cover accessible. So what we're trying to do essentially when we talk about design for closure is embodied in four principles that have been published by Robertson and Shaw. Essentially the first is to protect public health and safety. And the next slide I'll discuss how we do that. The same for alleviate environmental damage. We'll discuss that more together with three, production of a useful land form. And then four, to the extent achievable, you need to provide for sustainability of both social and economic benefits. Now, what the GUARD guide has provided, first I would suggest the recognition, similar to what John Hillenbrand previously mentioned, that it really is important we address the full mine life cycle. And in addition, they've also added something that I think is another implication we have to always consider, and that is the implications of temporary halting of operations or early closure of the mine. That can happen for financial reasons. It can happen for reasons of catastrophic failures. It can happen for combined reasons, but it does, in fact, happen all too often. Now, going into more detail as to that design for closure, when we talk about how to make sure it basically lasts and it's long-term, physical stability is essentially the key. This slide essentially suggests that it cannot, basically it must be stable and not move, can't deteriorate and fail. These are key aspects that in many cases with mine tailings, at least in past reclamation closure, have not been addressed. We still have mine tailings that oftentimes have not reached full stability, may not have been fully dewatered or various other things. And then oftentimes the structures we rely upon, let's say for example spillways on a closed tailings impoundment, those need to be something that we can rely upon for thousands of years to come. Now, from an engineering standpoint, we really can't do much more than suggest that we can build something for a 500-year period, perhaps. 200 may even be more reasonable from an engineering viewpoint. However, I'd point out that there are engineered structures. If you look at places such as what the Mayans built, various things, the Egyptians, that can last for thousands of years, if not more. And we perhaps need to take a more concentrated look in that regard. Geochemical stability is very important. As I mentioned yesterday, the whole subject of geochemical stability and geochemical aspects surrounding tailings impoundments deserves a hour or two course just on its own. But what we have to do there is see if we can halt, in particular, ongoing processes like acid drainage, and find a way to actually get to an endpoint with processes such as neutral drainage, where we may be seeing an endpoint in as little as 10 to 20 years in increasing amounts of contamination. We need to address that in tailings closure. Land use is something that has been done in various ways, forms. One suggestion I guess I would make is don't build a golf course on top of tailings or any other mine facility unless you're absolutely certain the golf course can pay for itself. I have enough personal experience, and that's why I bring that up. But tailings do require some form of an end land use. And wildlife uses, agriculture, various other uses are quite appropriate for tailings. To the extent we could use them for things like solar facilities, things of that nature, they should be given consideration because that could lead to a more self-supporting end result. And then finally, we shouldn't forget ever about sustainable development. Those of us that have grown up in, lived in mining communities and seen the impacts of closure, it's the type of thing we really want to try to look at and see if there's some way to sustain the benefits and other aspects that the mining did bring so we don't see that post-mining mortem, if you will. So with respect to decommissioning and reclamation, I think it's very worthwhile for folks to be aware of, again, the Canadian Dam Safety Guidelines. They speak very specifically to closure, and you can see the quote I've contained here is very consistent, if you will, with the previous discussion I provided, and that you know, many others have also consistently suggested. The CDA importantly identifies three main phases of mine tailings facility closure, and an understanding how mine tailings facilities are closed, going from operations to ideally a nearly walkaway. I don't think there is such a thing as entirely walkaway situation. We need to address those or know those. The first phase is what the CDA refers to as the transition phase, and it essentially starts when the facility has reached capacity or when the operation is completed. Now, that may be whether it's been completed because the operator temporarily closed and then didn't come back, or whether it was complete or terminated due to premature operation at the end of planned operations. The activities are very important to understand that need to be taken during this time. If you have a dam, what we really want to see is the actual breaching of that dam. The intent is to make the structure no longer a water-holding structure. In many cases, it may not be so much breaching the dam as grading the tailings behind the dam to a central spillway so that you can discharge that and avoid that. And that can also is done in a way that you have positive drainage throughout the top of the tailings so that you don't have water ponding behind the tailings. We also need to address storm events. And that's one of the things that I mentioned earlier, that we need to go beyond, I believe, current standards, where oftentimes we look at 25 to 100-year storm events for spillways. I think most modern regulations would require at least a 200-year event. And again, I think it's the kind of thing we need to really look at the sensitivity of incorporating a 500-year event, because it probably isn't going to cost us that much more to at least try to account for things like climate change. And then it's very important during this period that you install your reclamation covers. One of the questions that was raised yesterday is, what do we do about windblown dust coming from tailings? It's one of the reasons why water covers are used in a lot of situations. Once we go to the transition phase, we need to remove water under any circumstance. And as soon as we can install the reclamation covers, one of the great benefits in terms of dust control can be gained by doing that. And Bill will address more about that, as I've said later. The second phase is that of active care. This involves monitoring water management. If you have a water treatment system, if it's part of the dewatering requirements, then that includes that during this phase. One of the main things you need to keep in mind is you're still going to continue the surveillance and maintenance of the dam itself and at the surface of the facility during this phase. It also is a phase during which you're going to need to monitor to actually verify that the performance meets design criteria. And this means things like stability monitoring. It also means geochemical monitoring, and it can as well mean monitoring of your reclamation cover, the success of that cover, things of that nature. The goal is to achieve a steady state condition. And because of that goal being, you know, what we're trying to get to, in my experience, the suggestion that it can take a few years, as some approaches would do, really aren't bona fide. I would suggest that we're really talking decades in nearly all cases to achieve any kind of a steady state condition. Of course, the goal should be to achieve that condition earlier rather than later, and there are ways we can accomplish that, such as compaction of the tailings that is more easily accomplished with paste tailings or with dry tailings. We need to keep in mind during this phase also that there still can be problems. Total stability, for example, has not been reached. We can have new geochemical issues, seepage issues, and things that show up. So therefore, you need to maintain the emergency services, the other response abilities during this period. You've come nowhere close to a walkaway scenario yet. Now, phase three, as it's been identified by the CDA, is that of closure passive care. And important, similar to when we talk about passive water treatment, the idea of passive care is not that it's entirely a walk-away proposition. What this does mean is, first, that there really shouldn't be any active operation of the dam. No changes should be expected to occur. There should be a situation where, in particular, no major geotechnical or geochemical issues exist. That meaning essentially that you've reached that steady state condition I talked about. Now, how long should a steady state condition be reached before we can really feel comfortable? That's a question that I know a lot of folks have, you know, tried to address in closure, but we really haven't addressed it, I don't think. 25 years is probably a minimum, but we need to keep in mind, for mine tailings in particular, when we look at some of the long-term predictions for eventual acid drainage in particular, some of those won't occur perhaps 50 to even as much as 300 or more years in the future, at least according to the predictions that have been provided. So it may be that in order to achieve that steady state condition, particularly for tailings with acid generation potential, that we need to continue monitoring for as long as 500 years. That may be radical to some, but I would suggest that that is consistent with the science, if you will, that, and the results that have been provided by the mining companies in particular concerning tailings in some cases. Now, the passive care phase needs to continue until or as long as you require some level of inspection, safety reviews, and other aspects. And so my expectation is you can't walk away, as I've emphasized here. And then if events require a facility thought to be in passive care, and this is very important because a lot of impoundments, tailings facilities, may be thought to be in passive care presently or once we've even applied modern standards to, if they undergo significant modification, let's say, for example, they show stability issues, they require a tow berm, you return to the transition phase and have to wait until you achieve steady state again. This is interesting in that you might also think about how it applies to a stormwater event that might be greater than what occurs in the future, requiring one to go in and do significant modifications from an overall stormwater system design. So I just want to make sure folks understand the seepage side of tailings facility closure, because this is, again, a good example of where tailings facility walkaway scenarios are unlikely, at least within the time frames that most people suggested could happen. This is a graphic from the Nevada Department of Environmental Protection, and this is from their program, which I think is a very progressive program, which requires that there be fluid management, essentially in the form of both interim fluid management upon immediate mine closure all the way through process fluid stabilization. And this is a good graphic that shows how far they have suggested that needs to be carried out. The graphic starts with phase one, which is essentially when the mine closes, beginning that part, I was saying, that is the CDA first transition phase. You have recirculation of the tailings solution. You're trying to evaporate that solution or otherwise rid yourself of that solution, perhaps through treatment and discharge. And during that period, it's more or less 24/7 type operations. Now, within about 1 to 2 years, typically, you transition into what they describe at NDEP as phase two, that being the active phase. Again, that's it's very consistent with that of the CDA. And during that time, you're still continuing to rid yourself of solution from the tailings impoundment. Now, it may be that you've gotten rid of your surface solution, but now you're beginning to get into the, if you will, drain down phase. And if you look, the key to this whole graphic is on the left we have the flow rate in terms of gallons per minute for the amount of seepage which one would expect from a theoretical tailings facility. Starting at about 650 GPM, you can see that during that phase one, they drop down to around 200 GPM or so. And then phase two goes through to year five, where it's gone down to about 100 GPM. Now, a lot of folks expect on tailings a much sharper progress, if you will, towards a endpoint. But in fact, that's a characteristic more so of heap leach drain down, whereas tailings does, in fact, in most cases, take a longer period of time such as this. So this also addresses consolidation of the tailings and the time frame is necessary for that. Now, the next part of the graphic goes on to show years 5 through years 50. Phase 2 continues, the active phase that they're showing here, all the way through to about year 30, during which, again, you're still continuing to treat in a more active fashion, if you will, the drain down coming from tailings. In the case of Nevada, they can use evaporation, but many other climates and regional systems, you probably couldn't. So you'd be looking at active treatment and discharge. And then phase three, which again essentially goes into that passive phase that the CDA has identified, and they're identifying phase three, phase four in Nevada, but it's both are very consistent with phase three from the CDA, the passive phase. There you're looking at still a drain down treatment facility. In Nevada, that usually means an evaporation pond. You're no longer actively causing evaporation through mechanical means, but rather you're just addressing it through what they oftentimes refer to as an evaporation cell. At that point also, in this particular circumstance, though, it's important to note that even after year 30 and on through year 50, you're still expecting about 25 gallons per minute of seepage. Now, what Bill's going to present in terms of covers is suggestions for the best method to minimize that seepage. What I have to suggest, though, is no matter what the best method may be, my expectation would be, particularly on a large tailings impoundment, that you would see this kind of seepage go on from year 50 basically indefinitely, because I don't think a water balance cover or any other means, even an engineered cover, could be expected to eliminate seepage entirely from the large facilities that we see built today. Not to say you shouldn't try. This is a slide where I just want to again mention settlement. We're really talking the process of consolidation and the dissipation of poor water pressure. And it's important to understand that's what is taking place here. It has implications for both static and dynamic stability. It also relates to the seepage that's coming out. What we're really trying to accomplish here is the dissipation of that excess pore water. Because what that allows us to do is get a very dense soil matrix. We basically have a very low void ratio. And as a result, we end up eliminating issues that come later, such as cracking and differential settlement. Unconsolidated tailings, oftentimes when you go on top of those and do reclamation, you'll see that reclamation later be subject to the cracking and differential settlement. You'll see the covers on the reclamation. A good way to avoid that is simply to compact the tailings, as I mentioned previously, which you can do with both paste and dry tailings. Where you don't have that, what we most commonly do is install wick drains. There are other methods to speed that process or make that process happen if it doesn't otherwise happen. But wick drains really seem to be the most commonly used method today. With respect to mine impoundments, I spent a bit of time addressing that yesterday. I do, again, see them in many cases as being the best practice. They are what I would recommend. But I think it's important to emphasize, again, that they leak. We don't know how they're going to basically work over geomorphic time. Now, I should mention there are studies and other suggestions that we should be able to expect, in many cases, 200, maybe even 1,000 years of relatively good performance. But when we talk geomorphic time, we're talking even much, much longer periods. We're talking geologic time periods. So to suggest that miners will continue to work over those time periods, I don't know that we can. We have to address the fact that miners cause us to have basically water contained within these facilities, and we're going to have to basically eliminate that if we use liners. And in my experience, at least, once we use a liner, it may be we really force upon ourselves that long-term commitment to surveillance and maintenance. Our goal should be, in our design, to avoid that to the extent possible. Liners probably make it more required than less. So the suggestion I'm making is the use of liners should be avoided. Really, though, there may be only a few options to do that, such as both paste and dry tailings in particular. I want to take a few questions now and then turn things over to Bill.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Again, as Gene mentioned at the beginning, you can submit your questions using the Q&A pod in the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. So if anyone has any questions, feel free to submit them. I see some are coming in. We got a question from a participant who is saying that one of the objectives of designing for closure is to achieve a productive use of the land or return it to its original condition or an acceptable alternative. Do you think that mining companies should be required to identify that the land is reclaimed mine tailing sites so that if whoever wants to use the land will know ahead of time that the below the cover is mine tailings?
Absolutely. Without question. One of the areas I've had a chance to do some work on is that of institutional controls. And the idea of institutional controls is that while we might encourage reclamation with covers and other things, we haven't eliminated the existence of the potential hazard below that. Every Superfund site requires institutional controls. Have they been enacted? Are they in place? Do we have a system so that future users in particular down the road know that there's mine tailings below this land? I could not assure anybody today that we have that. It's certainly part of EPA's program. I know they've been working on it as part of Superfund. Really, they've had to address, I think, mostly the cleanup efforts, and it's now time, in my opinion, as well as many others, to turn their mind to that of the long-term aspects of these sites. But no, I think the commenter brings up a very good question in terms of just suggesting that there should be information in all cases so that people know what this land was at one point.
Right, yeah, and that's a very good point. As you mentioned, the EPA does have these institutional controls, and then we also have a Superfund Redevelopment Initiative program that works to demonstrate the types of reuse that sites can go into, and also talking about some of the issues of what the waste is that's there and making sure that's all disclosed. Let's see, we had another question from a participant who is wondering, if liners are eliminated in deference to paste or dry tailings, in what scenario do you envision not having the same long-term monitoring requirements? And they go on to ask, will there not still be the same or even greater potential for infiltration and leaching of undesirables?
No, and again, great question. I'm not inferring that we're going to be able to get away from long term. In fact, those who know my history know the type of issues I've gotten involved in and still do to this day. My own sense is that there are no scenarios, particularly with the type of major mines we're creating today, that you can walk away. We need to put in place things that will address the long-term, you know, aspects of these sites. The key to me, though, is that by going with something like drier paste tailings, it creates an opportunity to do early reclamation so that we can see the effect of that reclamation. If many mines that I've seen could have worked on demonstrating their proposed closure, not at closure, but rather beginning early in the operations, they would have realized that their proposed closure methods were not going to be effective. In the case of both, you know, dry and paste tailings, and again, dry may be forced in this suggestion, there are many cases where we're also going to still need to put engineered covers, impermeable covers of some sort on top of that material in order to keep it from leaching, essentially in creating too much exfiltration of contaminated seepage. So it's certainly not a panacea to get away from what needs to be done, but I would much rather put an engineered cover over a dry tailings than even begin to think about trying to accomplish the same over a formerly wet tailings at closure.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jim. Maybe we'll take one or two more questions before we move on to Bill's presentation. A participant is asking, what is the general time frame to achieve geochemical equilibrium after the placement of a cap?
Don't I wish somebody knew? You know, the prediction of how long it will take for something such as a cap to affect groundwater discharges, other things, is really an interesting aspect because I work on a number of sites where we're doing that and where we're now monitoring the impact or effect we're having on, for example, discharges from a tailings embankment containing nitrogen to groundwater. We don't know how long it's going to take. We're speculating, for example, in one case, the case I just mentioned, a couple of years, but it could take 5 to 10 years. Where we've actually done that at various sites, I don't think we've had a great deal of time and the necessary monitoring, although I think Bill's program has been involved in some aspects of this. Maybe he can talk to it. But we really don't have the data we need to be able to say exactly how long it's going to take. And so in a lot of cases, I believe there's a dependency upon things or an expectation on things to happen very immediately when, in fact, after you've installed a cover on a tailings impoundment, we may be taking, you know, talking 5, 10, even more years to really see the effect of having done that.
Okay, thank you.
I should mention I have seen cases where we have seen the effect in as little as a couple of years as well.
All right. Let's take one more question. Someone is saying that you mentioned that liners have the potential to contain water and contribute to potential instability, particularly over the long term. Does this mean that the water is pooling above the liner? And if so, how does it contribute to the instability?
Yeah, and that's a great question again, and I appreciate all the folks with their questions here. What we end up with in the case I'm describing, and let's say, for example, we take a situation where we have a line tailings impoundment that incorporates a drainage feature in the bottom of the impoundment, and it might be a pipe hooked up to a drainage network that helps to both drain and consolidate the tailings at the bottom of this line impoundment. And what we're expecting upon closure is an ability to leave that drain open and for that drain to maintain and function in order to keep water from building up inside that liner. So under the scenario I'm suggesting, that drain, for various reasons, geochemical reasons, biological reasons, physical reasons, a collapse in some way, might get plugged. And now we no longer have that drain functioning at the bottom of that bathtub, if you will, that plastic bathtub. The water will fill up, and in certain circumstances where we have a positive balance, you could actually see that water exceed the level of the liner and at some point go over the top of the liner in the future, particularly during a series of wet years or something like that. So that's the scenario we're trying to avoid. Now, as you raise the water level in the liner as well, you're raising the phreatic head. If this dam hasn't been designed, and for example, if it was not designed to actually carry the full amount of water responsible for ending up in overflow in a climatic situation that, caused that, then you could, in fact, exceed the design standards and end up with an unstable, potentially catastrophic situation. And I do believe there are some examples in history where that has happened. So that's essentially the scenario I'm talking about. There are, and should be, that I would suggest will require monitoring over the long term.
Great. Thank you again, Jim, for an excellent presentation, and then also the participants for all the very thought-provoking comments and questions that we got. I guess there could be some more questions that come in as we're continuing on with the webinar. So, Jim, maybe at the end, if we have some time, we'll go back into revisiting some of those. But now I would like to introduce our next speaker, Bill Albright, who's with the Desert Research Institute, and he's going to talk about final covers for mine tailings. So, Bill, the platform is yours.
Very good. Thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes, you sound loud and clear.
Very good. Figured out how to use my phone here. First of all, thanks for the organization of this webinar. It's good attendance, 175 people, I guess, yesterday. I'm sorry I missed yesterday. It sounded interesting, really interesting. I was driving down the east side of the Sierra enjoying a late season storm, which I'm sure everyone by now has heard of the terrific drought that the West Coast is experiencing. And right now the Sierra, I don't think it added much water, but there's a nice clean blanket of snow up there. So that was a lot of fun to watch. As you heard, I work for the Desert Research Institute, or I'm emeritus now. I retired a bit ago, about a year ago. And my experience with the covers started years ago working on a project at the Nevada test site, which is where the United States has conducted much of its weapons testing program, and it was with regard to radioactive waste. And the Department of Energy, who controls the nuclear complex, is very interested in performance of waste containment features facilities because they control much of the really serious hazardous waste in the country, that is the radioactive waste, even the low-level waste. And as a result, they've taken on a very performance-based approach to design. When I say performance-based, I mean, I'll get into this a little bit with my comments on regulatory philosophy, which now that I'm retired, I feel a little bit less constrained about voicing my opinions and perhaps biases on some aspects of regulatory philosophy. So you'll get an earful. I'm glad to hear that Jim and I seem to share a preference for performance-based design. And I think in large case that's because of the mining industry. The whole mining community has been less regulated than the municipal waste industry. And as a result, when I look at closure regulations and design in the mining industry, I'm really impressed at the progressive way that both regulators and design engineers and site owners approach the issue. But so it's, in some of my comments today, history is largely based in municipal waste, although I've worked on radioactive and mine waste quite a bit. So I do have kind of a municipal waste slant, but and most of you will work in all of these fields, and so you'll be able to easily sort it out. I had the opportunity to, early in my career, to work on an extraordinary program with the EPA called the Alternative Cover Assessment Program, which was largely the efforts of Steve Rock at the EPA. And Steve and Craig Benson and I ran what turned out to be a very successful program where we looked at the performance of all kinds of covers. We had an initial emphasis on what we call water balance covers, what some people call evapotranspiration covers. But we looked at clay covers and composite covers with geomembranes in them as well. And that was an extraordinary opportunity, and we developed some really nice technical guidance based on sound science. So let's look at the function of covers. Physical containment of the waste is is primary, of course. What I'm going to talk a lot about today is controlling the percolation in the waste. Sometimes gas movement is really important. I do a lot of work on uranium mill tailing sites, and there the primary interest is radon gas escaping. And what we want to do in that case is to slow down that gas. It's got a very short half-life, and we want to let it decay as it diffuses through the cover. In municipal waste, the loss of methane and carbon dioxide, which are important greenhouse gases, is also very important. So we're not only looking at water, we're looking at gas movement. And in the case of mine waste, that can be important as well. Movement of oxygen through a cover can contribute to an acid-generating situation. And, of course, there's vectors. And I was really encouraged to hear Jim's comments about what he called the geomorphic lifespan of a cover, and that's really important. The other day I was flying into Las Vegas, and on the final approach, you look over to those mountains to the northeast of Las Vegas, a highly weathered landscape, and right plunked down in the middle of it is a billiard table smooth landfill cover. And you look at that and you say, that's going to change. There's no doubt that the geomorphic processes that are at work there are going to change the shape of that feature without extensive and ongoing institutional controls. And so it is important to consider the not just maybe sometimes we have 30-year post-closure requirements. That does not even begin to include the geomorphic processes that are at work. This slide talks about conventional covers and water balance covers, which is a bit of a holdover from the municipal waste side. The conventional covers are typically covers where we have a hydraulic barrier, a low conductivity or a low permeability barrier, either clay or geomembrane or a combination of the two. And the idea of that is to just prevent water from seeping down. A water balance cover, which is a term we like to use, is a cover that operates on very different principles and is more like a sponge, one that absorbs precipitation and has the storage capacity or the sponge-like quality to store that precipitation and then return it later to the atmosphere via evaporation and primarily plant transpiration. So I'll talk about both of these general classes of covers. Excuse me. Conventional resistive covers with a soil barrier can simply be a soil layer, or they can have a soil layer over compacted clay, or a soil layer over a geosynthetic clay layer, what we sometimes call a GCL. And I've got a couple of comments later about GCL, some fairly recent research that points out some interesting facets of those. But basically, the idea here is that we have a low conductivity soil layer overlain, in most cases, by a soil, a vegetated soil surface, whose job is to prevent erosion and basically the effects of the surface environment, freeze-thaw cycles, wet-dry cycles, perhaps burrowing insects and burrowing animals. And in fact, what we see in these covers is that much of the water balance is maintained not by the resistive barrier, but by the vegetated soil layer on top of it. And that's the case with most conventional covers, is that water balance principles are very, very important to those as well. The next general class of conventional covers are composites, composite meaning a combination, where we take that soil barrier cover and add to it a geomembrane overlying the low conductivity soil layer. And the geomembranes, as we're all familiar, are very thick, very durable. Current research, which of course is an extrapolation, suggests that they have functional lifespans on the order of several hundred years. I've seen some reports that seem to suggest that they approach a 1,000-year lifespan. But that's based on a couple of decades of research, so you can add your own grains of salt as you see fit on that. Again, overlain by a vegetated soil surface to protect the barriers from the effects of the surface environment. Water balance covers generally fall into two classes, a monolithic barrier, which is a thick layer of fairly fine-grained or fine-textured soil, the sponge that I talked about. And then there's a variant on the design called a capillary barrier, and in which the fine textured soil is placed on top of a coarse textured soil, and that can effectively increase the storage in the fine textured soil. I teach a little class on cover design, and once we get to the point of capillary bearers, I say, look, forget about waste containment for the moment, but let's talk about irrigating your tomatoes in a desert environment. And of course, everybody in my part of the world sits up and listens. And in fact, you can make a garden bed, which is a capillary barrier, quite effectively to use less water and enhance the health of your plants. But that's another topic. By the way, I've had the opportunity to participate in probably 30 long day, 1 day to 3 day workshops on cover design. Some of you may have been in those. Craig Benson and I have taught a lot of those along with Steve Rock, and we're always open to doing more. Simple slide here on some basic characteristics of these different kinds of covers, including the percolation rate, gas flux, and cost. You can see there's a really large difference in cost. Water balance covers can be put in for often less than half of what a composite cover will cost. And they can function very, very well, as we'll see in some of the slides I have a little bit later. Let's go on. I'm going to touch briefly on design philosophy. And this, as I said, reflects some of my lot of experience, both in mine waste, currently in mine waste, and radioactive waste. And right now I'm working with the three eastern states in Australia who are all rewriting their municipal waste guidelines for covers. And I'm trying to exert maximum influence from out of their country in favor of a performance-based design process rather than a more prescriptive or conventional-based. But we'll get into that. Our conventional designs, those compacted clay covers and geomembrane covers, basically they rely on material properties, methods and materials, and that is the material of a geomembrane or a compacted clay and the methods of installation. And typically what we do is we assume that performance will follow. It's easy to be a bit cynical, perhaps, about these conventional covers. But when you look back 30 years or so when some of these regulations were devised, and what we knew then from hydrogeology and other sciences, there were reasonable regulations. We've learned a lot since then. The ACAP program had the first nationwide field scale direct measurement of the performance of all these covers. And so now we can look back and say, you know, regulatory engineering with this material and methods approach is probably not as good as a performance-based design in which we tend to say, first of all, what's the performance we need from this particular facility? How well do we need it? It's immensely expensive in some cases to say, look, we can tolerate no release from any containment facility whatsoever. That's an unreasonable cost to society, and sometimes that approach leads us down to an inappropriate design. So the performance-based design means you start off with a defined performance criteria, and then you design and you analyze and perhaps monitor that facility to see that it's performing as you intend. Some of the issues with prescriptive regulation are that, like I said, there's typically no performance criteria. We assume that the performance will follow from the materials and methods. And then when we look to performance-based designs in the municipal waste sector, they often require a demonstration of equivalent performance, and that's really hard because we didn't define the performance of the conventional cover in the first place, and there's usually no method established by which that comparison can be made. And then we oftentimes lose sight of the primary goal, which is protection of human health and the environment. That is, I think, we need to keep that front and center and make sure that all of our design follows that particular goal. Like I said, the cost can be immensely more expensive when we follow a regulatory engineering type of approach. And we often see, you know, every time we make a regulation, we almost always try to achieve a goal through indirect means. And almost by definition, that involves initiating what I would call unintended, undesirable consequences. And I think we can all think of examples all the way from environmental regulation to traffic control, in which we have regulations that are established to achieve a particular goal. They try to do it indirectly, and as a result caused some level of issue. So an alternative regulatory philosophy would be to focus on that primary goal and then say, look, this is what you have to do, and this process, not the design, but the process is what you need to follow. And that is to evaluate the type of waste, the waste packaging. That's particularly important in the radioactive waste business, in which a lot of waste is disposed of in containers of sometimes unknown porosity. And believe me, nobody wants to open up a radioactive waste container and look in for void space, although we do say that we take care of void space, when in fact we often don't. And anyway, this list here, climate, the depth of groundwater, this is a list that is not exhaustive by any means, and it can be added to or subtracted from at any given site. But if we require that a design engineer maintain compliance with the primary goal and then show how they address these other factors, I think that this benefits regulators, it benefits site owners and design engineers, where everybody can focus on the primary goal. So now that I've voiced some of my regulatory biases, let's go on to the alternative cover assessment program. That's where our sites were. We had a really wide variety of climates within the United States, all the way from Apple Valley in Southeast California, where it's very arid and very hot, to Southern Georgia, where it's quite warm and very humid, up into Montana and Cedar Rapids, and we really had a nice collection of climate. We built water balance covers at all those sites, and we had usually had the site's conventional cover tested there, and oftentimes, in most cases, a side-by-side demonstration. We built all of our data, and our conclusions and recommendations are based on drainage lysimeters. And what you see here is some photographs of construction. Drainage lysimeter is essentially a large bathtub in which we build. It's lined bottom and sides, and it's got a sump in the bottom. You can see in the lower right-hand picture there, that's the sump. And we build full scale in there, the cover, and then we monitor the drainage, and we have a lot of instruments in there. And you can see on the upper right-hand corner, we're welding up the corners there. And in the lower left-hand corner, you can see that we always maintain the proper ratio between workers and supervisors, about 2 to 8, I would say there. But this is direct measurement. In fact, a brief aside here into monitoring. When we want to monitor the performance of a cover, there's several ways of doing it. There's only one way to directly measure the performance, and that's with the drainage lysimeter. You can see in, I believe it's this slide. I'll come back to it in a moment, into the issue of monitoring. But we built these lysimeters using full-scale construction methods. That site there on the left is in a large mine up in Idaho, and you can see in the lower right there we're monitoring compaction of the soil while we're building the lysimeter. And the point is, we didn't hand-build these monitoring facilities. Back to the issue of monitoring, you can see that I'm putting in a soil moisture probe there in the upper photograph, and that's Craig Benson taking a large intact soil sample out of one of our layers. The only way to monitor directly is with a drainage lysimeter. They're expensive. They're time-consuming. They take years, really years, to get representative information from the performance of the cover. We sometimes monitor covers with just instruments alone, but that is subject to a high degree of uncertainty, and the monitoring system really depends on how well you need to know the answer. Science is all about uncertainty, and if you want to decrease your uncertainty, then you almost must have a drainage lysimeter to actually monitor the performance of a cover. And you can see this is a drainage that, I don't see the arrow. There it is. Thank you. This is the line coming out of our drainage sump of the lysimeter, and it's falling into a tipping bucket gauge there, and which measures the drainage. Thank you for giving me the arrow. These are the conventional covers that we looked at in the ACAP program. Most of them have a geomembrane in them. There's one here at Apple Valley. There's one at Albany, Georgia, and one at Cedar Rapids that were clay covers. Some of the conventional covers had a GCL under the membrane. And so we had a good representation. This is large. The focus here is three clay covers, and the others are conventional composite covers with a geomembrane. Let's look at compacted clay covers. Now we'll get into the meat of my presentation here. Typical clay cover has compacted clay overlain by vegetated soil layer. And the idea is that we can construct this soil barrier, which we know from extensive experience that we can construct these monolithic low conductivity layers. And the second criterion is that we need to protect the clay barrier from damage that may increase saturated hydraulic conductivity. And that is the functional basis on which clay covers are designed, and that is the low conductivity of this compacted clay layer. And we need to maintain that low conductivity for the design life of the facility. The kind of damage that we can run into are frost, death, freeze-thaw cycles, wet-dry cycles, differential settlement, and erosion, of course. I got a couple slides from my colleague Craig Benson's presentations here. They've done a lot of work on frost damage and other things. And with clay covers really are subject to frost damage if they're not protected from that. Horizontal ice lenses form in the clay barriers. And it turns out when you get ice forming in the soil, the vapor pressure of water from ice is much lower than from liquid water. So you get vapor transport up to the ice layer from below, which causes desiccation below the ice barrier. And so the ice lenses make horizontal fractures, and the desiccation of the soil below that makes vertical fractures, which is effectively slicing and dicing your clay cover. And they are very, very susceptible to that. This is when we excavated one of our ACAP clay barriers. What you can see here is a puddle of green dye, and we dug this trench through to the cover. And this fellow here is pointing to a green dye gusher coming right out of the clay barrier. This was about 4 years after we constructed this cover. We all know that we see clay crack, and then we see it wet up, and the cracks shrink, and we think it heals. And the real question is, do they heal? And we went back, and this is actually that same cover here. This cover was built in March of 2000, and you can see here we're picking this graph up about 3 or 4 months into the lifespan of this, or into our monitoring period. And you can see that drainage here, the percolation, was slow and steady throughout this period. In fact, it drained from day one because southern Georgia is really wet. But then it didn't rain for 6 weeks, and you can see this line here is precipitation. This line here, the green line, is the soil water content of the cover. You can see that it dried out. And after that, every time it rained, it would drain, and the net percolation increased dramatically, and it became very episodic. It became very like a stair step. Every time it would rain and drain. In fact, sometimes we would see it rain and drain within 5 minutes. And one thing that we can't see on this graph is that we saw this rain and drain phenomena not only when the cover was relatively wet, like here and here and here, but we also saw that rain and drain phenomena when it was relatively dry. So those cracks, even though they were both open and they closed, the hydraulic conductivity of the clay barrier was essentially destroyed by this one desiccation event right here. And it never healed, even though the clay barrier wet up and the cracks disappeared to our eye. They did not disappear to the water. And this is a very important feature and thing to remember about the performance of clay covers. We went back to this site some years later, 4 years later, in fact, and we did four tests, sealed double ring infiltrometer and some borehole permeameters here. And the take-home message to this is in the right-hand column over here, which is the factor by which the hydraulic conductivity increased. Now, this is the as-built condition, so the factor, of course, is 1:1. But by each of these fairly large tests in the field, the hydraulic conductivity increased by from roughly 1,000 to almost 100,000. And remember, this is the key parameter by which clay covers are designed, is the K value, or the saturated conductivity. So these covers change significantly. Let's go into composite covers. Check my time frame here. We're good. Composite covers, of course, have a geomembrane inserted over the compacted clay layer, and typically a drainage layer. Jim mentioned slope stability issues, pore pressure issues, and it's really important in covers, especially when you have a geomembrane in the cover. This is an example of a typical one, and I'm not a representative of any of these membrane companies, but these are good products. 1.5 millimeter LLDPE is linear low density polyethylene, and the drain, we like these drainage composites, which are essentially two layers of a non-woven fabric, and sandwiched between them is this heavy plastic grid. It has a very high hydraulic connectivity, and we've excavated a number of these that were buried for years, and they do stay remarkably free of soil clogging, although they can get roots in them, but the soil, they're very good at keeping the soil out of the inner part of the drainage layer. Chemical compatibility in geomembranes and covers is usually not an issue because they're on top of the waste. Bigger issues are constructability, cost, durability, and we can get them with texturing, which is really important when we consider slope stability issues. We like linear low density. We like the polyethylene materials really well. Drainage layers, I won't go into this extensively, but they need to keep down the hydraulic head on the barrier layer, prevent pore pressure buildup, which contributes to slope stability. And they can be either coarse-grained soil materials or geosynthetics. This is a slide that it doesn't quite show what I wanted it to. This is taken from one of our ECAP sites at Cedar Rapids. And we're seeing, if you look here, the month of May. And in Cedar Rapids, that is really a wet month. It's been cold and snowy all winter. Now it's warming up. And we're getting rain. You can see some precipitation events here. And when that happens, we get surface flow. And we also measured flow on the membrane in the cover. And that's what we call lateral flow here. And if you look, you can see that when we get percolation, which is not much, it's when we get lateral flow on the membrane. And this is kind of like duh science. I mean, we sort of know this happens, but no one had ever really directly observed this until we built the ACAP covers. And we said, oh yeah, when we get lateral flow, that's when we get percolation. And the other key point here is to this slide, despite the fact that these geomembranes are for practical purposes impermeable, they have construction defects and they have manufacturing defects. And we put a 1 centimeter diameter hole in each of our geomembranes, which is about frequency of defects about 10 times greater than acceptable construction standards. And so we had a hole, one hole by intent, in each of our covers. So, but we do know that, as Jim said earlier, there's no such thing as a no-flux cover. And in fact, geomembranes are not no-flux covers. They allow some flux through, and especially one of the things we haven't figured out yet is the importance of differential settlement, which is not, maybe not such a big issue with mine tailings, but certainly is a big issue with municipal waste and radioactive waste. I've got some information on that. This is another slide at one of our test sections near Monterey, California, in which we did not adequately protect the membrane. We were very careful, and we had some miscommunication with the engineering firm, and we put soil directly on the geomembrane. And what you can see here is very predictable. This is Monterey has got dry summers and wet winters. And we're looking here across an entire winter season, and we see precipitation here. We see surface flow. We see lateral flow, and we see about 50 millimeters or 30 millimeters a year of percolation. Remember, these composite covers rely on the barrier, and they have relatively thin layers of vegetated soil on top. And so the soil saturates, and water runs on that membrane very predictably. And when it runs on the membrane, we get percolation. In this case, an extreme example, but the point of this slide is that construction methods and quality assurance are very, very important when it comes to geomembranes. Summary, conventional designs. Composite designs, they restrict, you know what, I've got a performance slide a little bit later on, so I'm going to skim through this. I've got a redundant slide a little bit later on. Composite designs work very well. They restrict percolation to very, very low levels, and 5 millimeters a year, sometimes we say 3, but these are very, very low levels. Percolation coincides with flow in the membrane, and they require, absolutely require, very careful construction practice. clay bare designs, their performance degrades quickly. And we are now saying in less than 2 years the performance will degrade. And one of the questions that comes up is how deep do you have to bury the clay barrier to keep it away from the surface environment? And the answer to that is we don't know. But it's certainly deep. It's certainly, I would say, so deep that most sites will not want to undergo the financial liability for putting enough soil on top of it to prevent this kind of degradation. We know that the percolation is a result of preferential flow. We know that the damage persists. And as a scientist, I shouldn't say that they fail, but I will say that they're probably not suitable for the kind of applications that require long-term low permeability barrier. Craig Benson has done, and while we're on the topic of composite covers, I want to put a little information about geosynthetic clay layers. What we know is that GCLs have a sandwich of sodium bentonite between some geosynthetics, and we have a problem with divalent cations exchanging out the sodium in the sodium bentonite, and that changes the swelling characteristics of the clay. GCLs are a great idea. They're really convenient. They provide initially a very low connectivity barrier. But what you can see here is number of wetting and drying cycles. You can see that if we use DI water, distilled water, this GCL maintains its low conductivity through a number of cycles, whereas if we have water that has calcium chloride, the divalent cation calcium, what we see is after a small number of wet-dry cycles, the hydraulic conductivity goes up dramatically. And we know that this happens. This is just the result of the combination. Remember, it's two things. It's ion exchange of divalent for the monovalent sodium coupled with wetting and drying cycles. And I'll come back to the importance of this here in a little bit. This is related to the swelling characteristics of the GCL. And what you can see here is essentially the same samples subjected to the same kinds of water chemistry going through a number of wetting cycles. And this is now not a measure of hydraulic connectivity, but a measure of swell. And it essentially says the same thing. This one is a really interesting slide because we were concerned that GCLs would always suffer this dramatic increase in hydraulic connectivity. Now, these samples were taken from in-service caps that had been in the field for a long time. And what we see is that you have a number of samples here that resulted in very high hydraulic connectivity. We also have a number of samples here that retained their initial and desirable low hydraulic connectivity, and it's dependent on the water content in situ at the site. And as it turns out, if the GCL hydrates fairly quickly and achieves its design low conductivity character and then stays wet, it can then undergo ion exchange, but if it stays wet and doesn't dry out, it will maintain its very low hydraulic connectivity. And this is a very good thing for us to know, because if you cover the GCL with geomembrane, as we often do in composite cover design, the GCL will maintain its functional characteristics. And we had a chance to look at that. We did a little study on differential settlement at a hazardous and radioactive waste site down in the southeast, where it was a geomembrane underlain by a GCL and then a compacted soil barrier. And what we saw was, and you can see this is not very much distortion. This is a result of putting waste in place in containers. But we saw no damage to the geomembrane. We saw a large increase in the connectivity of the soil barrier layer, but the GCL was almost totally exchanged, but it retained its very low hydraulic connectivity because it had got wet and stayed wet. And this is good news. So that's something to consider. Now, here's our data from conventional covers. I'll go right down to the bottom here, these soil barrier covers. This is the average drainage we got out of these covers. Apple Valley is very dry, very arid place, very low precipitation. And if you don't have much water to deal with, and how much water comes through. But in southern Georgia and in Iowa, large amounts of precipitation came through these compacted clay covers. The composite covers, you can see, all worked well, with the exception of our site at Monterey, which, as I said, was damaged during construction. And that's the lesson there is pay attention to performance, or to construction, rather. But you can see that composite covers work well at all sites. In all climates, they require very careful construction, but we can rely on them to keep down the influx of water. I had a summary slide. I apologize for the redundancy, but composite covers can restrict percolation to very low levels. For the soil covers, very high, relatively high, much higher than we would expect from their material properties. Let's go on to the water balance covers. This was the focus of the ACAP program, and we looked at water balance covers of greatly different thicknesses. We had some capillary barriers, all the climates and all the ACAP sites, and our target for this was 3 millimeters a year, which was a bit artificial, but that's kind of what we were shooting for. And remember, as I go through these covers were designed before the program and did not benefit from what we learned from the program. These are the site characteristics, and I've arranged them here in order of precipitation. Apple Valley, very dry, 120 millimeters a year. Down in southern Georgia, over a meter a year of rainfall. So we did see, and we've got cold climates. We have a lot of snow in some of the places, Monticello, Utah, a lot of snow up in Montana. So we had good selection of climates. Now, let's go straight into the data here. This is at Marina. We call this the landfill of the rich and famous. This is near Monterey. Coastal climate, a thick soil layer of sort of sandy clay. It's fairly near the beach there. And it was intended to be a capillary barrier design, but it turned out to not function that well. Now, this slide here, I'll stay on this slide a little bit. This is water balance covers 101. We're looking at a few years of data here. And what you can see is that the climate in Monterey is wet winter, dry summer, winter, summer, and so on. And all of these, there's precipitation and evapotranspiration, and all these quantities are cumulative except for the water stored in the cover, which dries out in the summer, wets up in the winter, dries out in the summer, and so on. And every year, when we exceed the maximum storage capacity of the cover, which is that line right there, we get a little bit of drainage. And this could be regarded as failure. In fact, we saw roughly 40 or 50 millimeters a year or so. This could be regarded as failure, but remember, this is a test section, and this actually let the site know how much better they needed to make their cover to have it perform as they wished. And so what this tells you is when we exceed the storage capacity of the cover, then we get percolation. This is really different than conventional covers, which have a resistive barrier, which do not rely on storage. But these water balance covers do. So, lest you get disappointed about water balance covers from this slide, let's go look at Polson in Montana, up near Flathead Lake in northwestern Montana, my home state originally. And sort of semi-arid climate. We had a capillary barrier design, a lot of snow up in Polson. And guess what? Less than a millimeter of percolation over 5 years, which is remarkable. Now, again, we've got a somewhat seasonal climate. We're looking at multiple years of data, winter, summer, and so on. Evapotranspiration tracks precipitation fairly carefully. We did get some surface runoff. And I haven't drawn in the total storage line here because we never exceeded the storage. So we could calculate it from our soil hydraulic properties, but I prefer to put it on based on field observations. And this simply shows that in some places, if you design things right, you can get very, very low percolation rates from ET covers. In fact, this cover outperformed the composite cover at the same site in a side-by-side demonstration. These two lysimeters were about 10 meters apart. And so this cover worked extremely well. And there's some advantages to ET covers. They are inexpensive, and they can last a long time. So here's our data, summary data for water balance covers. And this time, I've arranged them not in order of precipitation, but I emphasized over here some of these covers, the ones that are highlighted in yellow, worked extremely well. Some of them did not. One of our covers at Sacramento, which was a surprise to us, Omaha is, when you come across the United States and you hit about the 100th meridian, the water balance kind of changes. In fact, the pioneer farmers discovered that. Up in Cedar Rapids and down in Albany, Georgia, there's just a lot of water there. So managing the water with a water balance mechanism is very challenging. But some of these sites, these ones that are highlighted in yellow, we had some zero. Up at Boardman, Oregon, no percolation. At Helena, Montana, none. At Monticello, Utah, high altitude site, 7,000 feet, lots of snow, less than a millimeter a year. These covers perform on the order of a composite cover, and this is good news. So water balance covers are definitely a valuable tool to be used in closure. I want to put this in there. This is a sort of a repeat of the slide at Monterey. I had this line drawn in there about the total storage of the cover, which if we exceed that, like right here and right here, then we get little episodes of percolation or even large episodes of percolation. What we really need to do is to provide for this required storage, which is from the driest the cover gets to as wet as it gets, and if we can account for that amount of water, then we have a successful cover. And this is the topic of a workshop that Greg and I do. We go through all the gory details of soil physics and numerical modeling and all this. But I'll say, in favor of my children's college fund, you're welcome to buy our book, which is Water Balance Covers for Waste Containment, in which we outline this two-step method for the design of water balance covers. And that is essentially to estimate the required thickness. We've always been able to get a pretty good handle on what the available storage is in a cover. It's obviously a function of the thickness of the cover, and it's obviously a function of the hydraulic properties of the soil. And we've always known how to do this, to evaluate the available storage in a cover. What we never knew how to do was to evaluate the required storage. In other words, how much water does this cover have to store? And before, we would address it, and we'd say, well, have it store all the water for an average precipitation year. Well, that's not realistic. In a cold climate, maybe have it store all the water for the cold time of year when there's no transpiration. And that's a better method, but still not very good. We went through the entire ACAP data set with a very mathematically inclined PhD student, and he figured it out, and he came up with a very good method for estimating the required storage based on the monthly precipitation and potential evapotranspiration for a site. And that method is clearly and it's easy. It's a very simple spreadsheet-based method, no computer modeling, basically, and it's described in simple detail in our book. So, and Dennick, you raised the question, to what use do we put numerical modeling? And I would argue that numerical modeling still is very important to look at what-if questions. What if you have a fire and burn all your vegetation and have no transpiration? And sometimes, and the list of what-if questions is probably limited by the number of sites that we have. It's site-specific, and there's no way of coming up with all the what-if questions. But numerical modeling certainly is a valuable tool. Back to the regulatory framework. When we started this covers business, we had these conventional covers in which we assumed the performance would follow. And we assumed, for example, that no water would go through a composite cover because of the geomembrane. And now that we know that clay covers change their performance dramatically within the first year or two of operation, and that composite covers leak some, and that water balance covers can work extremely well in some places if they're designed, then we start to wonder if we should rethink our regulatory philosophy and framework. And my own opinion is that what we ought to do, or we should do, is focus on the goal and have this be the single requirement, protect human health and the environment, and then have prescriptive the process by which we design a cover, not the design itself, but the process, and to consider such things as this list here. I don't know if I put cost in there, but if I didn't, I should have. Stakeholder views are really important. Waste packaging is not a typical problem, but it is in some kinds of waste. distance to the nearest receptors or sensitive environmental niches. And of course, modify this list to be site specific. This is what a regulator and a design engineer should focus on, is this list. And then the regulator, this is my opinion again, should say, look, this is your goal. Go ahead and consider these factors. And now the design engineer should look at these prescribed factors here and conduct an analysis and look at and then define a performance criteria. Percolation, gas release, erosion, containment life, what's the life expected lifespan of this containment facility, and then select an appropriate design, analyze it correctly, monitor it, and maintain it, monitor it if you're required to. And this approach has worked well, and what it requires is this last bullet in red. There needs to be, in most cases, some ongoing and perhaps long-term relationship between regulators and everybody else to ensure that we all have significant trust in the procedure and that we have a shared goal. To the real goal, or shared dedication to the real goal, which is this one up here. And so with that, I'll conclude my presentation here, which admittedly is a bit long on personal opinion and bias. But like I said, this is based on 30 years or so of working in these things in a variety of waste types, from municipal to hazardous to mine waste to radioactive waste, both within the U.S. and outside the U.S. And I really think that this is a good regulatory framework. This last slide has some publications, and I think these are all posted on the web. The water balance paper we published just a few months ago by Preacha Appalwantrigoon, and it took me a while to remember how to pronounce Preacha's name, but he did a brilliant job of looking at the ECAP data. He's the one that designed our design process to determine required storage. This paper is newly out. It's available, and it's long and packed full of information. And this paper here that we came out in 2013 is about composite barriers. That's all the composite barriers in the ACAP program. These two papers here are about the clay covers. One is about all three clay covers, and one of them is about just a clay cover in southern Georgia, which was quite an interesting story from a hydrogeology point of view. These two publications, one of the things that's interested in is that we know we can engineer a soil layer to have certain prescribed properties. What we don't know is how long those properties will persist. And we decided to look at that question, and we went through an immense amount of work. Thank goodness we had a small army of big, strong graduate students to lift these very heavy intact samples out. But most of that information is in this large report for we did for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I think is posted online that you can go look at. And it's several hundred pages long, and it's got a huge amount of information. The only one that's not available online is, of course, our book, and that's available from the American Society of Civil Engineers Press, and I think the link to that is online. So, Michelle and Jean, that concludes. I think it's time for a few questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Bill. Yeah, we've got a number of questions that came in while you were presenting, and I want to encourage our participants, if you have any questions or comments, to please submit them in the Q&A pod in the bottom right-hand corner of the webinar platform, and we'll get to as many of these questions as we can. So I guess I'll just start with some of the questions that are coming in for you, Bill.
Sure.
We have a participant who states that the discussion of performance-based requirements versus prescriptive requirements is timely in light of the Mount Pauley expert panel report. And that report, I guess, prescribes avoidance of wet TSFs. Do you have any comments on that outcome of the report?
I've heard of that particular site. I'm not well versed in it. I should be. And enlighten me a little bit on wet CSS. Jim, if you're on, maybe you can.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe Jim, this would be a good question for you.
Yeah.
He's still available.
Sorry about that. Could you ask the question again, perhaps?
Sure, not a problem. First, there was just a comment that, you know, in discussing performance-based requirements versus prescriptive requirements, it's timely in light of the Mount Pauley expert panel report. And I guess the report prescribes the avoidance of wet TSFs. I mean, I guess, first of all, if you could talk a little bit about what wet TSFs are and any thoughts on that outcome of the report.
Well, again, I think for those of you who were on for the last 2 days, we've talked extensively about what a wet tailings facility is in terms of a 40 to 60% solid slurry being discharged into a tailings facility and also combining storage of water. And the Mount Pauley expert panel has suggested that there should, going forward in particular with new facilities, that we should no longer have wet tailings. Again, I think it's very important to first understand the context of what the Mount Pauley expert panel was asked, and that was essentially what their recommendations were relative to British Columbia. A good example is I certainly don't think their recommendations are applicable to oil sands, tailings and impoundment facilities. They should clarify otherwise, but I suspect they did not mean to apply that to those facilities because there's a different aspect of those facilities given a foundation conditions that are much more well understood, whereas literally every hard rock mine foundation condition is different. But anyway, I should let the expert panel speak to that hopefully at some point. But very importantly, the idea that we would say there never will be another wet tailings facility, I think we need to be just cautious with that. I do advocate and support everything the panel has suggested, but I don't think it precludes there being wet tailings facilities if a site-specific aspect allows it. A good example is if there's simply as a result of a wet tailings failure, no catastrophic impact in terms of impacts to landform, ecology, and other things, and it may be that there's no such thing. But if there were such a thing, then you might, it certainly should be back on the drawing board or back on the list of things you might consider.
Yeah, that was a bit of a complicated question from a cover's point of view, because I talked about covers in terms of their design of the cover itself. In this case, the question I think has to do with the actual characteristics or prescriptive nature of the waste characteristics.
And again, I would point out that the panel was also relying upon what they described as best available technology, that they felt very clearly.
Yeah. All right. So.
Okay, great.
I'm not sure that answered it, but let's go on to the next one.
Okay, yeah. So we've got a lot of participants just thanking everyone for their presentations over the last 2 days, so I wanted to point that out and echo that thanks. And then we got a comment that design covers using geomembranes can be financially unfeasible in countries where these geomembranes maybe aren't manufactured. So do you think that a water balance covers can be effective in countries with tropical climates, say in areas where the precipitation is about 1.5 meters?
That's an interesting question, and I'll go back to what I considered the performance-based design process. And that the first step there is to define what are your performance criteria. If you focus that question on the performance criterion of drainage alone, and if you decide that your criterion is a small number, like say less than 5 or even 10 or even 20 millimeters a year of drainage, then my answer is no. Our experience is that we're not going to see very low drainage numbers in very wet climates. Now, the caveat to that is that the answer is it depends. And that is what we see in Australia in some tests there. We see excellent performance of water balance covers in humid climates for a combination of reasons. They have, first of all, generally very tight, fine-grained soils because Australia is old, and the soils are highly weathered, clay-rich. They get high-intensity precipitation events that tend to create a lot of surface runoff, and the result is less water infiltrates the soil surface that we would see from those kinds of annual precipitation figures in the U.S., and the covers perform fairly well. So that's the answer always is, unfortunately, it depends. And then the last thing I would say is that sometimes, and I must hesitate to say this, but sometimes you're faced with the question of let's do the best we can with what we've got. And if that's the case, then certainly we can greatly reduce the influx of water with a well-designed water balance cover.
Okay, thanks. We got a couple questions about watering and covers that have plants on them. The first question is the cost of the water that you need to establish the plants or maintain the plants, is that factored into the cost of the cover system when you're having plants growing on top of it?
Oh, those costs I had were extremely general. And, of course, that answer is much more site-specific than that. Even with conventional covers, where the cost of the membrane is well known, even the cost of the underlying compacted clay layer is highly site-specific, depends on transportation costs and such. Watering can be important. Generally, though, we want to have plants on the landfill cover that are successful in the environment of the site, and that oftentimes points to native plants. I hesitate to say native plants only because, to me, plants are functional because they draw water out of the soil. And I don't really, in some sense, I don't care what plant it is. But native plants oftentimes will perform better, and oftentimes will take over anyway. In the long run, they will colonize the cover. So it's a good idea to consider them. And a little bit of interim water is really not an issue because most of these sites have been open for years, if not decades anyway, to the precipitation.
Right. Okay. Let's see. There's another question about someone's wondering if the covers are designed so that an industry can go in and extract some of the tailings materials, say, in the future if they want to manufacture something out of the tailings, like a fertilizer?
All that takes is a D10. Yep, you can remove a cover. You certainly damage the geomembrane if you remove a cover. But we have seen cases, we've had cases where with soil covers, people came back in and pushed the soil up and for whatever reason. Yeah.
Okay. Someone wants to know if you can speak a little bit about the water balance covers in high precipitation environments. And they indicated that your data might show that some poor performance of these.
You know, that's similar to the one question you had earlier. What I should point out is that, like I said, I made a comparison between our program here and one, a similar one that Craig Benson and I participated in Australia. And they got significantly different results in high precipitation areas, and the reasons were, as I mentioned, the type of soil and the intensity of precipitation events. The answer is it depends. And you have to look, if you have a site, you have to go in and look at the precipitation. Is it rain or snow? Does it come in high intensity events, or does it come in week-long low precipitation events that are really effective at putting water into the soil? Does it come in the wintertime? Does it come in the summertime when the plants are all transpiring water as fast as they can? What's the humidity of the site? And then, perhaps most important, you have to ask yourself, how well does this cover have to work? Like I said, there's no such thing as a zero-flux cover. We can optimize the actual very, very, very best cover if people want to undertake very high cost is a composite cover with a fully functional optimized ET cover on top. And in some places that can be a very thick ET cover with a capillary barrier and then a composite cover and even a multiple composite, but I'm exaggerating here. But we have to combine all these factors of performance criteria with the site characteristics and available soils. And my first question when people ask me if they think a water balance cover will work, because my first question is, how well do you need it to work? And that oftentimes gets a blank look. And then then you undergo a conversation, and I have no problem saying to people, no, it won't work to your specification. But I also have lots of cases where we've said, yeah, we think it'll work well.
So. Okay, great. Another question has come in. Someone wants to know, how long does it take for conventional tailings to consolidate, and is it necessary to wait before installing a cover to reduce the risks associated with differential settlement?
I'll give that one to Jim. I think he has talked about that. He talked about it a little bit this morning earlier.
Yeah, yeah. Did you hear that question, Jim? Would you like me to repeat it?
No, I did hear that. You know, again, we've seen tailings consolidate so you can begin reclamation. I've seen it as little as 2 years. I've seen other cases, though, where up to 10 to 20 years later, we did see significant differential settlement occur. So the suggestion is that again, you know, Bill and I will probably harp on the same thing endlessly. It's very site-specific, and the degree to which you can do reclamation in a short time frame versus perhaps needing to do an interim cover and wait for final reclamation for consolidation to occur, that depends, again, on your objective. If you're trying to install an engineered cover, a composite cover like he's describing, and you need to have a high performance from that cover, because that's usually why you would do such a thing, then you would need to, you know, assumedly have a fairly stable foundation condition. And so depending upon the nature of the tailings, that could take from 2 to 20 years, but you should allow that to occur before you do final reclamation if your goal is to have a highly competent cover with little or no percolation.
Okay.
Little, because again, Bill's right about no not being realistic.
Yeah. Okay, great, thank you. It looks like we have one more question that's come in. Someone wants to know if you think there's benefit in developing test covers for modeling.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's the ACAP program, we went out and built these covers basically for a nationwide program, and we weren't too concerned about how the data from those facilities were used by the sites. But since then, both Craig Benson and I have built a lot of lysimeters. We're up to about 50 now or so, all over the U.S. for different applications and out of the country. And there's a couple of reasons. First of all, you can build a lysimeter to collect data in support of a design effort. And if you're going to do that, you better plan some years out. Kind of depends on the site characteristics. In a very humid environment, you might get good data in a couple of years. In an arid environment, it might take several more years. But that gives you the very best data for basing a design effort. In fact, the very best data that you can get from a lysimeter if you're testing a water balance cover is some drainage. A zero answer is not particularly useful. Because what happens then is the site owner and the regulator get into an argument about how they can degrade the design and still meet the performance criteria. It's better to have a little bit of drainage, and then you have a much more solid basis for discussion about the final design. But you can also, right now we're working on some sites where we're collecting field data, very complicated sites, high altitude, lots of snow, which is really a challenge. And one of the requirements, one of the regulatory requirements there is to match a numerical model to the data, which we've not been able to do well enough yet. In fact, not well at all. And the issue there is we collect these fields. We tend to trust our models. We think we know how things perform. And then when we go out and actually make a direct measurement, like I said, lysimeters are the only way of making a direct measurement. Then we sometimes compare them to our model results and say, oh, my goodness, we're really way off. A bit of detail about lysimeters. The lysimeter gives you a direct measurement of the drainage. And then we put a lot of soils instruments in the soil, and we usually have a meteorological station to collect a variety of things. And those provide all the interpretive information. If all you have is drainage, then you might say you know how much drainage you have, but you oftentimes don't know why. If all you have is the instruments, you see a lot of interesting phenomena, but you don't know, you have a huge amount of uncertainty about the actual performance In other words, the drainage of the cover. The combination of the two is immensely valuable. If you think back to those slides I showed about our site at Monterey, we saw drainage at the same time we saw the soil moisture come up and exceed the storage capacity of the cover. That's information. You have the direct measurement performance, and you have all the data that lets you explain why the cover is operating the way it does. So regardless of whether you're using it as a monitoring tool or as a design tool installed some years before you're actually going to do full-scale construction, lysimeters are really bad. They're expensive. There's no doubt. Craig and I think we can build a lysimeter start to finish from scratch and pay for everything for about $160,000 or $70,000 for one lysimeter, and that's expensive. But you know what? Some sites look at the regulatory issues and the cost of conventional covers, especially composite covers, and they find out that it's a very reasonable investment when they look at the big scale. One of our sites estimated their savings of $54 million by getting approval to use a water balance cover. So these numbers, as we all know, these numbers are big.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Great. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers over the last 2 days, John Hillenbrand, Jim Kuipers, and Bill Albright. I think this has been a really interesting presentation and very informative about mine tailings and their operation and some issues that can occur and how to close the facilities. And I think it's helped answer a lot of the questions that people who are working on mining sites need to know, and now they know where they can get more information also. So I really appreciate everyone's time today and yesterday and answering all the questions from our participants is really valuable, and I'm so excited that we're going to have it archived for future. To Jean Ballant, who's going to show us some closing slides. I'm also going to show you, let's get to the front of this. I'm going to show you some information about an upcoming webinar that we have on June 4th, where we're going to have a presentation on soil remediation and phytotechnologies at the Anaconda Smelter site. And there are some links here that you can follow to get to the registration for that, so I'll encourage you to attend that webinar also. And with that, I think, Jean, you can close us out on some of our final slides here.
All right. Thanks very much, Michelle. I'll just walk the audience through just a few items before we close out today. If you're interested in learning more about the Internet seminar, such as the series you've just presented, or want to learn about other archive sessions, new guidance publications, or other resources related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup, please be sure to connect with us here at the Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. You'll find us at cluin.org. You can also find us and follow us and connect with us on popular professional and social networking sites such as Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. We often get requests for lists of training records or webinar participation. There is an online tool at the following URL on CLUIN where you can actually enter in your own email address, and we will automatically send you a table that lists all of the webinars that you've participated in live, in other words, that you checked in and attended live. If you need additional help documenting your participation, you can feel free to email me directly. As noted, we do have presentations available to download on the resources or links page. We also have a collection of other mining-related resources, so I encourage you to take a look at those. Those resources and slides will be available from today forward, so if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the archived version of today's webinar, you can still follow those links that you'll see on the right-hand side under related URLs. Click on any one of the links of interest and press the Browse To button to open up those sites and files. I'll ask each of you to take just a brief moment now and fill out our online feedback form. We do read each of your submissions, and we count on those types of feedback items to help us continue to deliver free online sessions through the Cleanup Information Network. If you share the line with multiple individuals, each person can hop on and fill out their own version of the form, and that form will be active from today forward. So again, if you're watching the archive version, you can still share your feedback based off of the archive following the feedback form link under related URLs. It also helps for those of you looking for CEUs or PDHs. If you fill out that feedback form, there is a box you can check, which is circled in red in that illustration, that as long as your email address is entered correctly and you check that box, once you submit your feedback, we'll send you an automated email confirming that you shared your thoughts after the live delivery. Again, you can still do this through the archived version. Usually, when you're trying to document participation in a webinar, if you have copies of the materials or a registration email, along with this type of feedback or confirmation email, that's enough to document with your accrediting institution. Again, if you need additional assistance documenting participation, you can feel free to reach out to me directly at balance.gene@epa.gov. I want to thank my organizers and presenters who joined us over the past 2 days to help deliver today's webinar, as well as the nearly 160 individuals who joined us for today's part two. As noted, today's session was recorded and will automatically be archived on the CLUIN website. So you should receive a separate email for parts one and parts two as soon as that archive is available for free replay and download. And I certainly hope that we will find you joining us on a future CLUIN seminar. Thank you so very much for joining us today. This will be the formal conclusion for our live broadcast.